Welcome to Faith and Family. I'm Andy Bates. A couple of topics to address today. Always topics pertinent to faithful family life. We're gonna May is Mental Health Awareness Month, so we're going to address that today, particularly mental health and congregational life. We'll talk with Pastor Jeff Fluke. He's been a guest here on Faith and Family before. We'll visit with him about that particular issue, mental health and congregational life. We'll take a look at one of the articles from this May issue of the Lutheran Witness. A student from Southern Illinois University Edwardsville contributed an article this month, so we'll talk with Ian coming up around 10:30, and we'll also hear from our friends in the LCMS Office of International Mission, find out what's going on there and opportunities to serve in international mission as well. Well, I want to say thanks to our underwriter, Concordia University, Wisconsin, for supporting Faith and Family here on Worldwide KFUO. We are very grateful for their support and glad to be in partnership with them in telling the good news of Jesus, supporting faithful family life here on Faith and Family as well. You can find out more about them on our website. Go to KFUO.org and look for the CUW logo in the sponsor section. Joining me by phone now, the Reverend Jeff Fluke, pastor of Faith Lutheran Church in Madison, Indiana. He also served on the LCMS Disabilities Task Force. Pastor Fluke, welcome back to Faith and Family.
Thank you for having me, Andy.
I enjoy our conversations when we get to talk from time to time, and love sharing with our listeners the wisdom and experience that you have, and give us all an opportunity to learn and grow from that. Pastor, tell us a little bit about your ministry there at Faith Lutheran Church in Madison, Indiana.
Well, it goes back a good 20 years, and really it starts with things that happened in my family. Before I was a pastor. In fact, I was a pharmacist at the time. And in 1983, we had two children, and one was 19 months old, the other was 6 months old. And our 19-month-old became severely ill, and there was 2 weeks in the hospital, just very, very stressful set of circumstances. And my wife was a registered nurse, and she cared for our daughter day and night, and something happened, and to try to be as brief as possible, our daughter did well. There was a rare tumor on the back of her heart. It took actually open heart surgery finally to get to that, and she recovered and is doing quite well, married, living in Phoenix, and is also a pharmacist. But during that, there was a stay in the ICU, and all that pressure, it got to my wife, and that was my introduction to severe mental illness, and it was really a very tough thing, and for 2 years, she was in very deep psychosis, and we tried everything. My pastor in Hoyleton, Illinois, in fact, he's been a guest on, I think, your program several times, Peter Kurowski.
Mm-hmm.
And then also Pastor Tom Baker. He was a former pastor of mine. I worked with those two men a lot. I worked with Dr. Hanschke when he was at the seminary. Took my wife to these various places, and we did everything we could, but nothing would pull her out of this psychosis, and it was just devastating for our family and two young children and so forth. But by God's grace, he led me into a local mental health community center, of all things. It was an act of desperation. And we went into that office, and it was a tough, in those days, things were tough. Family was always problems when it, you know, a source of the problem when it came to mental health and so forth. And so we didn't see eye to eye, but to make a long story short, I was allowed into the doctor's office. I always remembered the man. I love him dearly with all my heart, but at the time, he and I didn't hit it off real well, and he was a very brilliant man, but he was an atheist, and I always remember one phrase that he gave me. He said, "You can have your psychological papa in the sky, but we're going to treat your wife with medication." And being a pharmacist, I was very afraid of the meds that they had out there because of side effects. But of all the meds that they put her on Haldol. And because we had tried everything else, we did it. And within 2 weeks, after 2 years, all the delusions went away. And that was an epiphany, to say the least. And it just changed our life. And a couple years later, we went to the seminary, and I became a pastor. And that experience, though, influenced me. And we've had many relapses over the 30 years. Then when the son, who was 6 months old when my wife was ill, when he was 18, he developed severe schizophrenia, paranoid schizophrenia. And his has not been as responsive to medication and therapy like my wife's has. And then, just in the past few years, I've got another son, and we have a dual diagnosis, or co-occurring disorders of substance abuse and bipolar. And so it's a wide variety of things going on, but it affected, then when I came to the congregation, I actually broke down in the pulpit after I'd been there several years. I hid this from so many people. I always had people to talk with, but because of stigma and shame and all these things that happen to families that endure these things, I was able to put up a facade. I was pretty good at it. But I remember one Sunday I broke down, and so the cat was out of the bag. I had developed a relationship already with the people, and they were just so supportive. And so that led to things that we're doing now at our church, and we're a small parish here in Madison. It's definitely not what we would call a Lutheran territory like St. Louis or Fort Wayne or, you know, those kinds of areas. But we did have a state mental institution also when I was here. It's literally in my backyard. And so we have always had Christmas parties, things like that for residents that are over there. And then just in the past few years, we started getting involved with a group called NAMI. And I know you've had guests before. I know Linda Preuss has been on KFUO. In fact, it was through her that I first heard of NAMI on KFUO. And that went to St. Louis and listened to a workshop she did, and then came back here, and we had went to Cincinnati for training or just to listen to a class on, it was called Family to Family. And so, to kind of bring this to a close, two big events in our family's life was, one, the use of medication, how it helped so much for my family, and then to have people in similar situations and to be gathered with them and then to be educated and to learn various skills to help your family member. And then dealing with folks here, and there is so much going on in a family dynamic with guilt, and there's spiritual issues, and there's just family tensions, all of this, that instead of me having to drive 75 miles to Cincinnati, we wanted to have something here in Madison. And so for 3 years, we're starting our fourth year, we've been able to develop a family-to-family class, and then a support group for the family members, and then also what's called a connections group. And that's for those that have an illness, that they can get together and have support. And there's other, we haven't been able to do, there's so many things that can be done. We haven't been able to get an education program going for them. Those are difficult to get going, but we are striving after that. And I would say that we've had 25 families or so that we've been able to touch, and it's had an impact on the congregation. It's had an impact on our circuit. We're actually going to plan a circuit convocation next year and focus on mental health. And in fact, we've asked Dr. Pless from Fort Wayne to come down and talk about Luther and letters of spiritual counsel, and then have a couple other speakers. I'll be one of those. And just to get awareness out there, to encourage folks for education, to be educated as to what mental illnesses are. And then there's some real tangible coping skills and family dynamic, things that can be done for the family dynamic. And in a sense, for me, sort of, we're a small population that are afflicted with these kinds of illnesses. But it's, I always kind of think, there's the 100 sheep and the lost sheep. What can we do for that sheep there in particular, and then how it brings blessing to the whole flock.
Prior to your family's experience with mental illness, what was your perception of mental illness, of individuals who experienced mental illness, or their family members who cared for them? What was your perception of mental illness, or maybe misconceptions about it?
Yeah, misconception. Very. That's an excellent question. And to my shame, it was in my family. I had an aunt who I now understand had schizophrenia, and we called her Crazy Aunt Charlotte. Okay, this is in the 1960s. And so it was sort of the attitude that it was a character weakness, character flaw. They just need to sort of get their act together, straighten up. You could blame other family members. You could blame, in my aunt's case, she was sort of a high-strung person. And there was a lot of the blame game, and I can't say that I looked at it as a spiritual crisis. Now I've run into folks that look at it that way, and there's sort of that's part of the dynamic. But as far as the cause of it, I didn't really look at it at all as a biological based illness. And again, I'm dealing in the area of severe mental illnesses. Schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, obsessive compulsive disorders, eating disorders, the PTSD in particular, is one that's really in the headlines today as well. The effect of stress on the body, I didn't really consider that, and I sort of joined in on the stigma side of things.
Once you started to, I think the first encounter was with your wife's experience after the long hours caring for your daughter in the hospital. Is that right?
Yes.
How did you react as that was developing? Did you start to see signs and recognize what was happening, or how did you realize that it was? When did you come to learn that it was a mental illness?
Yeah, it really was I knew it was a mental illness. It was how to treat it. Mm-hmm. And that was really when I went into the psychiatrist, an atheistic, anti-Christian psychiatrist's office, and medication took away what we were struggling with over 2 years. I mean, it was, I can't overemphasize how that changed my thinking. And again, this is 1983. Psychoanalysis and Freudism and all those things were still heavily influential on things, and they weren't looking at it as the biological nature of the brain back then. And so I forget the first part of your question, but I mean, that was the turning point, was how medicine helped.
You, if I recall correctly, you said it was 2 years of trying to find a solution, trying to find relief for your wife. What about you? How did you cope with the challenges that come from this, from mental illness of a loved one, of your spouse, and all the other family things that were going on, your daughter's health, your other children as well, all during that 2 years? I'm sure that was a very stressful time.
Yeah. Well, I can't thank enough my pastors, and I mean, it was the church, but it was, everything was always done in confidence. You didn't talk about these things, so you isolated yourself immensely, and yet I would go out. I mean, if I went back today where I worked as a pharmacist, the people had no idea. All right, they knew that Monica was losing weight and those kinds of things, that she was quiet, but they just wouldn't have known the extent. And back then, I just don't think that there was as much understanding as to what was going on as it is now. So my pastors, I taught my father-in-law, who he had 10 children, and my mother-in-law had something not as severe as what happened to my wife, but he had an understanding. My parents, I hurt their feelings because I really didn't talk with them because I knew of how our family sort of felt about other family members with it. And the good news is that's all different, okay, now. But I remember my mom saying how that I didn't really talk to them a lot. So that was just my self-defense mechanisms. I hid it from my children. The children didn't know. My oldest, until she became about the 7th or 8th grade, that's when I started talking to the kids, because sometimes when their mother would have a relapse, you couldn't tell. That's the thing with some of the illnesses is that you don't know unless you get in and ask because it's the paranoia and those kind of things. It's just a person retreats and becomes quiet and doesn't share that. And she was able to care for our family and those kinds of things. So not everybody will have the same experience that I had. But I think that so much of it was just having wonderful pastors who kept taking us to Christ, and Romans 8:28, how God works all things together for good, and not understanding it, but still just being strengthened by God's Spirit through the Word and with His sacrament. I mean, the church was everything for us.
What are some misconceptions that the church congregations may have regarding mental illness and what they can do as a congregation?
Yeah, education is really a key thing. Is that every congregation is going to have an individual that has a severe mental illness. And the percentages that it vary depending on where you go, but it's like schizophrenia would be one. Say 1%, something like that. And if you combine them all, maybe 5-6%. So you've got individuals there, but the attitudes are just going to vary depending on the individual. We had that conference at the seminary a few weeks back, and a man went to the mic who was a pastor, and he showed described how his congregation had sort of turned against him, and that's not supposed to happen to you if you're a pastor. And when I was a circuit visitor, I saw that there would be maybe something in the information about a pastor's mental health or somebody in the family, and it sort of broke my heart. I didn't say anything. Well, I did bring it up to one congregation, but they would always take that pastor's name and put him in. There were always three piles, somebody we're very interested in, someone we might be, and someone that we probably shouldn't consider. And if you ever had a depression or something like that, it always went over in that third pile, and that always troubled me. And so really I think what's happening now is, especially with our with the Gulf War vets coming back and the PTSD being more and more out there, and we're talking about it as a society, we're finally beginning to make a social contract with those that have a mental illness, just like we have social contracts with those that have heart disease or diabetes or cancer. You know, we'll have the walks for those that have breast cancer and things like that. You're starting to see that in the area of mental illness. And so I would just encourage congregations more and more that, especially if you've got a loved one, there's help out there. There are networks that are wonderful, and I can give some resources and so forth for you on that to direct people where I've at least found help. And so it's really in education, and then if what a person or the family needs, there's this sense of isolation. They need somebody to come alongside them and simply listen to them. And don't make judgments, just listen and be there. I had an individual once that just went on and on and on the phone with me, and I was so frustrated, and I finally said, well, what do you want me to do? And he stunned me. He said, you've already done it. You listened to me. I felt completely inadequate in what I was saying, but he just needed somebody to talk to. And so congregations and pastors in particular, because they're on the front lines for counseling, the folks that have an illness need a friend. And then they need a sense of self-dignity, because it's so hard for them to have a job. And so we have a man here in our congregation who offered my son where he could just work maybe 3 hours a week. Now, he hasn't taken him up on that offer, but what I'm telling you is that when a person comes to church that has a mental illness and they're not employed, people are saying, well, what are you doing, Phil? And, you know, where are you working and this and that? And my son says, Dad, what am I supposed to tell him? That I go to group? But for a while, he had a job in a bookstore, 3 hours a week. He can now tell them, I work in a bookstore, and I'm, you know, it's like I'm contributing to the community, and there's some self-worth and dignity, simple things that we can do. And so if members have some kind of business that they can have patience and just offer a person a three-hour-a-week job, the benefit of that would just be amazing. And so to come alongside, be a friend, and is there some type of a vocation that you can offer an individual? And then to be there for the family, and education, going to NAMI and some other organizations. I know time is short, but can I give you some places to
Certainly.
Refer people?
Certainly.
Okay. The first is that our own Senate has a website. It's lcms.org, and then you just go /disability. So if folks go there, and you can go down, there's articles. And now, that'll include all disabilities, so you would want to look for the mental health side of things. Another is Todd Peppercorn's book, I Trust When Dark My Road. And if you just Google that and put LCMS with it, it'll take you right to a site, and you can have that book as a PDF form. Then two secular organizations, www.NAMI, that's NAMI.org, and just click around, and there's just it's a source that you can a place that you can really trust its information, and that is good for family members and those that have an illness. For those that are just in the community and so forth, there's this group, Mental Health First Aid. So if you go to mentalhealthfirstaid.org, they can really help folks that don't have it in the family. And I would really recommend pastors and other church workers to, it's an 8-hour, you can sign up for an 8-hour course on that. And then two other things, there's a video, two videos, documentaries. One is called Shadow Voices, and that's put out by the Mennonites. It's very, very good. And then the other is mindsontheedge.org. That is a PBS Frontline series, and that will take you into the dynamics of what's going on in communities.
Well, very helpful resources. With just about just less than a minute left, one last question that you had mentioned that, you know, as a pastor, you kept the mental illness in your family hidden. You kept it hidden, kept up a facade for quite a while until it finally broke and the cat was out of the bag. What is the risk that one takes when sharing about mental illness in their family, whether it's their own or a loved one? What is the risk of not sharing with just about a minute, Pastor? I know that's a lot to pack into 1 minute.
Well, it's just, you're not getting the help that is out there. A similar thing is the people that have a mental illness, so often they don't want to seek treatment. If there's, for those individuals, please, there's help out there. And the Lord has given us some wonderful things. It's not a perfect treatment plan, but there are medicines, there's folks to talk to, and you're not alone. And so that's kind of the theme that we have with especially NAMI and mental health folks, is that you are not alone. And so that's the danger of the isolation. And I was stunned when I went to Cincinnati, and within an hour of meeting about 15 other people, we were, you become lifelong friends, okay? Mm-hmm. And it's just that connectedness. I've told folks a group like NAMI is kind of the closest thing to being church without being a church, and that may apply to other sort of organizations as well. But anyway, that is, we're made, God has made us as social beings, and so there is recovery. The recovery is possible. Recovery happens. And another word for recovery, then, is that there is hope.
Our guest today, the Reverend Jeff Flug, from pastor of Faith Lutheran Church in Madison, Indiana. Pastor Flug, thanks for being our guest today and helping clarify some of these points for us today.
Thank you, Andy.
Coming up in just a little bit, we're going to take a look at the current issue, the May issue of Lutheran Witness. Hear from one of our college students, Ian Kinney, is a student at Southern Illinois University Edwardsville. Takes a look at some of the issues that our college students face on campus today in an article in the Lutheran Witness. We'll talk with Ian in just a little bit. You're listening to Faith and Family on Worldwide KFUO.
Concordia University, Mequon, Wisconsin, overlooks the beautiful shoreline of Lake Michigan. This serene main campus of CUW is just 15 miles north of Milwaukee, with all its vibrant cultural attractions. At Concordia University, Wisconsin, students living by the motto of Inspiration in Action can choose from 69 undergraduate majors, 14 master degree programs, and doctorates in pharmacy, physical therapy, and nursing practice. For more information or to take a virtual tour, visit cuw.edu.
You're listening to Faith and Family. I'm Andy Bates. We are talking with contributors of the Lutheran Witness, May 2016 issue. Joining us by phone now, Ian Kinney. He's a student at Southern Illinois University Edwardsville and a member of Trinity Lutheran Church in Millstadt, Illinois. He's also author of Think and Test in the Quad and the Classroom in the May 2016 issue of the Lutheran Witness. Ian, welcome to Faith and Family.
Thanks for having me, Andy.
I should say welcome back. You've been a guest on Faith and Family before. As we've talked about other students or other subjects relating to students, I think you were you visited us once before and talked about attending Christ Academy. So glad to have you back on Faith and Family. You wrote an article for the Lutheran Witness this month, Think and Test in the Quad and Classroom, about really aiming at what we need to do to prepare students or what students can do to be prepared for the things they face in college. And we'll get into that in just a little bit. Let's talk about what you're doing at Southern Illinois University Edwardsville. Ian, what are you studying? What are your plans? What are you hoping to do once you graduate?
Well, right now, I'm in my third year at the university, and I'm in the social work program with a minor in classical languages. And I know that's a really, really bizarre mixture, but I'm pre-seminary, so at the end of this semester in the spring, I'll be sending in my application to seminary, where hopefully they would let me in. So I'm pre-seminary with a bachelor's degree, a hopeful bachelor's degree in social work, and a minor in classical studies right now.
So preparing to go into the ministry, preparing to go on to seminary for service as a pastor serving in the ministry and studying an interesting combination of things, social work and classical languages. Is that right?
Yes. Yes.
So as you came to the university and started this whole different world, this world of academia on the college level, what were some of the questions or what are some of the unbiblical ideologies you and other students have encountered in college, whether it's been your own experience or those of friends at other colleges or universities? What are some of those unbiblical ideologies that you or others face?
Well, there's quite a few that range across the pretty wide spectrum of issues on the campus, whether or not it's just the way that academia is conducted in the classroom, or it's the advertisements that the university will put forth, or have advertising in the student center, or things like that. Specifically, I had to take, as many do, a lot of general education courses, and so they covered a broad array of different classes, being that they are just general education. So it would be physics and biology and secular philosophy and things like that. And so, besides of all the what I would call a general overview of how the campus operates in kind of an anti-biblical worldview, there's also the very distinct ideologies that are taught in the classrooms that are very very explicitly not in line with the Christian faith and very unbiblical, to say the least.
So, how did this compare to perhaps your experience as a high school student or as a middle school student? How does this college campus environment is it different or is it similar to what your high school experience was like when it comes to worldviews and as we were talking about unbiblical ideologies?
Well, for my grade school, I went to a Lutheran school, thanks be to God, and I was very lucky enough to be grounded and founded in the faith there while I was in very formative years. And then for high school, it was a mixture of I guess what would be called a small town next to a metropolitan area and things like that. And so, regardless of what that was like, though, and what high school was like, there was still a fact of how when I was done at the end of the day, I would go home and I would see my parents. I'd see my mother and father, and then on Sunday, I knew that I would go to my home church and I would receive the body and blood of Christ, and I would be refreshed with the fellowship of the faithful and things like that. And so the point I'm trying to make is that I would come home and I would be able to have the support system that I did, who would reinforce what I knew to be true. Whereas at the university, I've lived on campus for the whole 3 years that I've been here. And that's not the case for myself and for everyone else who's not a commuter, who lives on campus. You're dumped classes, but then you go back and you're by yourself or you're with your roommate. And that's just the nature of the beast of becoming an adult and learning how to live on your own. But unfortunately, what I saw is that very often, unfortunately, people would not have the reinforcement of their parents or their family or things like that. And so they would sometimes, unfortunately, very quickly drift away from the faith and even more so drift away from regular church attendance or church attendance at all. And so just the fact of being on your own and not having a family and a church who knows that you exist, you know, there's not as much of a support as there would be when you're in high school or even in grade school and you come home to your parents every night.
So that network that of family, of faithful parents and the local congregation that support you in the word, that encourage you to study God's word, to be in divine service regularly, that certainly was helpful to you as a student. And many students are kind of separated from that when they go away to college.
Right. Yeah, they are. And it's for some people, it's kind of what they look forward to, I guess, when they, you know, they've been under the thumb of their parents for so long or whatever, and they can't wait to just get out and be on their own and do their own thing. And while, like I said, certainly that's an important part of becoming your own person and growing up, unfortunately, the circumstances and surroundings that you are surrounded with probably is not going to be the best for your spiritual growth and still living in the Word and in the church and things of that nature.
What do you do when you're faced with a question especially about these unbiblical ideologies or your worldview or matters of faith. What do you do when you're faced with a question that you're really not sure what the appropriate response is? You don't know what the answer is to that, especially while you're away at college, something you don't know the answer to. How do you handle those questions?
Yeah, and that's pretty tough, because when you come to a college campus, there's not only the professors who are, I mean, it's kind of their job to be smart. So not only are they very trained in the subjects that they're teaching, but then there's also the students and the grad students who are also very likely of a different mindset and ideology than you, and have thought about this and have rehearsed what they're going to say and ask and why they understand the things they understand. So it's very common for these different kind of questions to come up. And so personally, I try to make sure that I have a firm grasp of what the scriptures teaches and what we believe, teach, and confess. But if I would not know the answer to what someone was asking me, thank goodness I have people I can go to, pastors, church workers, things like that, people I can go to for these answers. And so hopefully if I'm having some sort of discussion with somebody where they ask me a heavy question or a heavy topic, we would hopefully at this point have some sort of relationship where I can tell them I don't know, but I can find out. Also, unfortunately, a lot of times on college campuses or with people that are the college age and things like that, the questions that they would ask that I guess would be stumpers or gotcha questions are working from an a priori knowledge, a presupposed knowledge that they just accept as the norm without actually looking into that first. So there's different ways to delve into something when they bring up whatever it may be, the problem of evil or things like that that you would get prompted with, where they're starting from a presupposed knowledge that they just assume to be correct in the first place.
Why is it important for a pastor to stay in touch with his college students even while they're away? What can a pastor do that is helpful for those college students during that time when they're away? We mentioned earlier that, you know, that many students may look forward to that detachment from family and home life. But what can a pastor do for those college students?
Right. And as I mentioned in the article, it's very unwise to start, obviously, to start building a relationship with the young people and the parish, you know, a year before they're about to go to college, when they're juniors and seniors, and you're like, oh no, I've got to get working on this. It's almost too late at that point. And that's unfortunate to say, but in some cases it really rings true. And so, and obviously this is the pastor's job, and surely he knows that, but to catechize and teach the students the faith as soon as possible. And obviously that starts in the home, but for the pastor specifically, for him to teach the faith as he's called to do for the students as soon as he can, so that as they grow in their years, they can grow in the knowledge and understanding of the faith. And by the time they do get to college, they can be able to adequately and rationally and reasonably discuss that with other people. But also when they do get to college and when that time does come, hopefully a relationship is built. And so what is so helpful is when the pastor keeps in touch with the actual parishioner and lets them know that, yes, I know you're going to college, and you know, just like a parent would, I know you're going to college, but I want you to know that you do have a spiritual father here. You do have a family that you can come back to. You have me who is going to be praying for you and thinking about you and doing whatever the pastor can do. Even more so, something that I've heard different pastors say, especially campus pastors, is how helpful it is for pastors who are sending parishioners to college to tell the local campus pastor or the college town's pastor, heads up, so-and-so is coming to this college, and it would be great if you could reach out to them as the campus pastor. From what I've heard from different pastors say, that's just one of the best things that can be done, is either make a personal introduction between the pastor and the incoming freshman to the college, or or just let the pastor know, here's their name. You can look them up on social media, or here's their email. You can contact them. That's so helpful to the campus pastor, so they can reach out and continue the job that had been started when the student was in high school and grade school and so on.
So starting early, teaching, catechizing, and doing all that preparation before it's the time for them to go away to college is a much stronger and better way to prepare for those days in college than the summer before they leave.
Right. Right.
Ian, thank you for this article, the hashtag Believe Boldly column in the Lutheran Witness this month, and for sharing your story about your experience as a student and God's blessings on your preparation for serving in the ministry as you study and to prepare to serve in the ministry in the future. Thanks so much for your time today on Faith and Family.
Thank you so much, Andy.
Do you enjoy using good old snail mail? Writing a letter, a postcard, or using a typewriter to do the same? Why not send Worldwide KFUO your letter today? Our street address is Worldwide KFUO 1333 South Kirkwood Road, St. Louis, Missouri 63122. And just a click away, 24 hours a day, you can find our contacts page at kfuo.org.
The Christian Church remembers the ascension of Christ not as a story of Jesus vanishing, but a story of Jesus ascending to an eternal throne. So farewell songs are not the order of the day. Songs of majesty and celebration are. You'll hear them on the next Sing for Joy.
Sundays at noon on KFUO, the messenger of good news.
God's word is our great heritage and shall be ours forever. To spread its light from age to age shall be our chief endeavor. I'm William Whedon, LCMS Director of Worship, inviting you to be sure and join us as we romp through chapter after chapter of the Sacred Scriptures, rejoicing in the salvation that's ours in Jesus Christ. Join us.
Thy Strong Word, weekday mornings at 11 on Worldwide KFUO. Underwritten by Lutheran Heritage Foundation, lhfmissions.org.
In the hymn, Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing, we sing, Here I raise my Ebenezer, hither by thy help I've come. The words refer to the Lord's merciful deliverance of his people and the joyful response of faith. Because God-given trust in our Redeemer remembers the history of his saving works and proclaims them to heaven and to our neighbor. The prophet Samuel set up a special stone of remembrance and named it Ebenezer, promising never to forget the Lord's deliverance. In this special season of the church year, we recall that even when we forget, the Lord remembers our helplessness and continues to strengthen us through his precious word. Join Concordia Historical Institute as we trumpet Christ's redeeming work in the life of the Lutheran Church, as we raise our Ebenezer, our memorial to the Lord's continuing deliverance of his people. A blessed Eastertide to you and yours from Concordia Historical Institute. Visit us at ConcordiaHistoricalInstitute.org.
You're listening to Faith and Family. In studio with me today, David Fiala, director, or he's with recruitment, LCMS Office of National Mission. David?
International Mission, Andy.
Did I say national?
You did.
International.
International Mission, Andy.
Oh, my word. I know that. I just typed it wrong. International Mission. David, how's it going in International Mission for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod?
Well, thanks be to God, we have got ourselves a really quality handful of missionary candidates whose names we are presenting to the Board for International Mission, who will soon be receiving calls or solemn appointments to serve as internationally deployed missionaries for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. That board meeting is later in the month of May, But what this does for me is this already has me setting my sights on our next major call cycle that we are seeking missionary candidates for.
So what types of skills, what are we looking for? What parts of the world are we hoping to send missionaries to in this next round?
Everywhere.
Everywhere.
Everywhere. We're looking at the Latin America region. We're looking at the Africa region. We are looking at the Eurasia region, and we're looking at Asia as well as the South Asia Oceania. So we are looking to send missionaries all around the world from places like Germany to Papua New Guinea. And I can't think of two more dramatic extremes than those, but to those places and all points in between. So we really have a large section of vacancies for missionaries. And when we're talking about missionary openings, we're talking about career missionary openings. So these are for folks who are willing to think about serving for 5 years or longer. And we're also looking for geo-missionaries. Geo-missionaries are globally engaged in outreach, and they serve for a minimum of 24 months. We also have lots of short-term opportunities for individuals and teams, but I'm focusing primarily on the geo and the career openings.
And I've had an opportunity to talk with some of our geo missionaries. That's a neat thing to do when you're, you know, when the chapters of life are changing. Kind of
indeed.
That can be. Is that a good thing to do as a gap year?
For instance, yeah. Everybody on Facebook, my Facebook feed, I see more things about this Obama girl and her gap year before going to Harvard, and now everyone is talking about gap year. Well, I heard gap year for the first time when I was in Europe as a missionary myself, and I heard gap year, and I'm like, well, what's a gap year? So I learned about this about a decade ago, and now all of a sudden it's on my Facebook feed for the president's daughter. But if you're interested in, say, a gap year following your college graduation, before you would, say, get fully engaged into your call or your vocation or your profession after your college education, we have geo-missionary opportunities that we are eagerly looking for young, vibrant, excited people to fill. We're also looking for, say, young at heart, vibrant retirees to fill. The geo positions are, you know, they're a term commitment. You know, when you start, it's 24 months. And depending on the role, sometimes those can be extended by a year or two at the completion of the initial 2 year term. So we're looking for all sorts. And for instance, I'm working with the deployed missionaries on the field who are requesting the geo missionaries. And right now they're updating their personnel requests. And I get those, and I work with our communications department here in the building. And we put together something that I call a geo missionary service op page. And we post those, really long title there, but a geo op page.
But, you know, I was going to say, like, Lutherans will probably create an acronym or an abbreviation of some kind.
Yeah. Yeah, just the geo service op. And we post these in two places on the internet where you can find them. And I just received two that I'll be posting today that just got tweaked. And we post these on lcms.org/service. You have to hunt around on that page a little bit to find geo service opportunities, and they're posted there. They're also posted on the Facebook page for LCMS Missionary Recruitment. You can search LCMS Missionary Recruitment on Facebook, or possibly Become a Missionary as one big long word. And I will post these geo service op pages on that Facebook page as well. And funny story, I was in Kansas for the LWML District Convention a couple weeks ago, and I was sitting down having lunch with just a group of random ladies who, there was an empty seat, and I said, can I join you? And they said, yeah, please do. So what do you do when you're sitting down eating lunch at an LWML? You start talking about missionary service. And I'm looking at these ladies going, okay, so which one of these either has had a cool mission experience that's going to come to the table, or is going to have an interest that's going to just come up in conversation? And seriously, these ladies were all just telling stories about where they'd been and what they'd done and their granddaughters and, you know, whoever it was. And one lady started talking about her own personal experiences. And I went, ooh, maybe this is the one. Maybe this is that one lady who is really going to spark an interest, and she's going to want an application, and we're going to talk more, and she's going to put her name down and say, please consider me. Well, she didn't. But about 3 days later, I get an email from her saying, I have a friend who has been working in Muslim and immigrant outreach here in America. And what you said over lunch about what we're doing in Germany, I think would be right up her alley. So I got her friend's contact information, and I've already started having a conversation with her about the possibility of serving as a missionary in Germany, doing outreach to all these Middle Easterners that are fleeing the Middle East and going to Western Europe. Our partner church in Germany, the ZELK, the Independent Evangelical Church in Germany, please don't ask me to say what it is in German, but the English translation is the Independent Evangelical Lutheran Church in Germany, and they are our full partner church. They are seeking LCMS missionaries to join them in their ministry to this migrant people group that is desperately in need of the gospel. So, for instance, this is just one of the many positions that will soon have a pretty geo-op page posted, lcms.org/service, and on Facebook. And if you are interested in serving as a missionary, you listeners out there, or if you have a friend or a kid or a grandkid or a niece or a nephew or a neighbor, the first kicker is the people we send as missionaries, they have to be members of a Missouri Synod congregation. We are the missionary sending agency of the Missouri Synod, so we want to send Missouri Synod members as missionaries. That's the first kicker, and that's the qualification for any missionary applicant. The next major qualification is, can you or this person, can you articulate your Christian faith as it's found in scriptures and in Luther's small catechism? Can you talk about your faith in those terms? Those are basically the two fundamental things that we look for in every candidate. And then depending on the position, we drill down to other areas in life where you ought to have a specialty or a skill or an education, et cetera, et cetera.
I'm intrigued with just a few seconds left. You mentioned Oceania earlier.
Oh, yeah.
What opportunity in Oceania? Can you share that?
Papua New Guinea, that island down there that we started doing mission work in the 40s, and we've done some wonderful things down there. The Lord has blessed the work. There is a church body there, an independent church body, that is the result of the Holy Spirit's work through these missionaries. And we're looking for a guy who can fix, build, or maintain anything.
Does it have to be a guy?
Or a gal, I suppose, but I think in my mind's eye, I see like the fix-it man. But if it's a fix-it gal, so be it. Do you know somebody who's a good member of the Lutheran Church who understands his or her faith and loves being a Christian and wants to help a partner church body and our missionary team on the ground of theological educators and teachers? We need a hands-on guy who can fix, build, or maintain anything.
Email address.
David.Fiala, that's F as in Frank, I-A-L-A, at lcms.org.
Very good. Phone number?
314-278-9750.
All right. Thank you very much, David Fiala, Office of International Mission Recruitment.
Listen to Faith and Family Monday through Friday at this time. Faith and Family is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for Faith and Family to continue. Our address is 1333 South Kirkwood Road, St. Louis, Missouri, 63122. You can contact us on the web and download Faith and Family at KFUO.org. Worldwide KFUO, on the air, online, and on demand.